You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grevet. Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grevet. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a world without GMOs, a thriving world where our food is safe for our children and our grandchildren. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. We have an exciting show for you today, and this is our 100th show. We have brought you some of the best experts in the world to talk about food and issues pertaining to our food supply. Some of those guests have included Vandana Shiva, Charlotte Gerson, Jeffrey Smith, Jean-Michel Cousteau, William Ingdahl, Dr. William Davis of Wheat Belly, Sally Fallon, just to name a few. All of those shows are archived on our website, and we are not going to let you down today. We have another amazing guest. My guest today is Dr. Russell Blaylock. Dr. Blaylock is a nationally recognized board-certified neurosurgeon, health practitioner, author, and lecturer. For over a quarter of a century, he practiced in the demanding field of neurosurgery, in addition to having a nutritional practice. He recently retired from his neurosurgical duties to devote his full attention to nutritional studies and research. Dr. Blaylock has authored 3 books on nutrition and wellness, and we are so excited to have him on our show today. Before I introduce Dr. Blaylock, I'd like to let you know who our sponsors are today. They're very important to us, and they help us bring you this information on a weekly basis. Our sponsors today are Wild Dolphin Swim Adventures and Bioluminous Spirulina. Hi, it's Carol again. I don't endorse many products, but Bioluminous Spirulina is one product that I highly endorse. Spirulina is called a superfood because its nutrient content is more potent than any other food. It has been proven that you could actually live on this product. Bioluminous Spirulina is the premium spirulina. It contains more phycocyanin than any other spirulina. Phycocyanin is a powerful antioxidant. It is grown cleanly without any synthetics, GMOs, and pesticide. And it's also a proven immune booster and is a radiation protectant and cleanser. I've been taking this product for over a year, and I feel like it's one of the finest whole food supplements on the market. To find out more about Bioluminous, go to www.newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. Once again, that's www.newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. Or just go to the show page and click on the link. You're going to really love this product. Have you ever dreamed about swimming with the dolphins in the wild? I'm not talking about what you do at dolphin quests or the ones in captivity. I'm talking about swimming with them in an integrous and respectful way. The dolphins love to play and interact with humans. And at Wild Dolphin Swim Adventures, we can make your dream come true. I'm Carol, and I'm a certified life coach, I'm a food educator, and the host of Food Integrity Now. Please join me for a 7-day retreat to experience the beauty of an ocean view home, organic meals, individual coaching and group coaching, and of course, swimming alongside the dolphins. This is truly a trip of a lifetime. To find out more about our upcoming trip this October, go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or email me at carolgrevet333@gmail.com. Again, that's Carol, G-R-I-E-V-E, 333@gmail.com. Dr. Blaylock, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
We're so excited to have you on our show today, and this is our 100th show. And we're so proud of the shows we've done over the past 3.5 years and bringing great guests like you on the show to educate people about what's happening with our food supply is part of that.
So I wanted to start out today with talking about excitotoxins. You wrote a book called Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills. Let's let our listeners know, what is an excitotoxin and why have so many people never heard this word?
Well, it's kind of surprising, particularly in the fact that the field of excitotoxicity has just exploded since I've written the book back in the late 90s. This is a principal area of research, particularly in all neurological diseases, because it's playing such an important part. Basically, what an excitotoxin is, it's a particular group of amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. We call these acidic amino acids, and the primary ones are glutamate, aspartate or aspartic acid, and cysteine. Those are the principal ones. And what was observed back in 1967 in some literature that was virtually lost at the time, kind of buried, these researchers found that if you took animals and you fed them high levels of glutamate in the form of monosodium glutamate, or MSG, the food additive, that it destroyed virtually all the cells in the back of the retina of the eye, which is your vision cells. Later, a neuroscientist a few years later found this article and repeated the experiments on a number of mice and found out that it didn't just destroy the back of the eyes, the sight neurons, but it also destroyed critical areas of the brain. Then he started looking at doses that were lower and found out you still had damage in these critical areas of the brain. And what he observed was that when you took these neurons, these brain cells, and exposed them to MSG, the brain cells seemed to be all right for about an hour after exposure, and then just out of the blue, they shriveled up and died. And when he measured the electrical potentials after adding that MSG, he found out the nerve cells were just firing their impulses like crazy. They were just going like a seizure or something. And they essentially were burning themselves up. So he called this an excitotoxin, which is an excitatory poison, because it's exciting these cells to the point of death. Since that time, we've learned a lot more about these excitotoxins. In fact, we've discovered that it is the most abundant neurotransmitter in the brain. Everybody's heard of acetylcholine and epinephrine, dopamine, serotonin. The excitatory receptors in the brain, the glutamate receptors, make up 90% of all neurotransmission in the cortex of the brain and over half of all the neurotransmission in the entire brain, which means it is utilized more often than all the other transmitters put together, and it seems to interact with them and plays a big role in controlling all these other neurotransmitters. So it's incredibly important in brain function and brain pathology. Well, since that discovery, since we've discovered that there's receptors in the brain and that glutamate is a major way brain cells communicate, they discovered that it's also one of the most toxic of the neurotransmitters. And because it's so poisonous to brain cells, there's elaborate systems in the brain that try to keep the amount of glutamate outside of the neuron where it can do damage extremely low. The concentrations are very, very low. And so when an impulse is going to be triggered by this excitotoxin or excitatory amino acid, it's released in minute amounts only for a fraction of a second. And then it's quickly taken up to prevent the brain from shorting out and burning itself up. Well, what they found out is in a lot of neurological disease like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig disease, it seems that this protective mechanism is not functioning well and the glutamate starts to rise in the brain and burns up these brain cells, and that's what leads to these diseases are playing a big role. Well, the big shocker was when they discovered all of these things, well, people were putting an enormous amount of this in foods, particularly the processed foods, the junk foods, in the form of monosodium glutamate. Well, the researcher that discovered excitotoxicity Dr. John Olney presented this before Congress, a congressional committee.
And when was that, Dr. Blalock, when he presented it before Congress? I'm just curious.
Yeah, this is back in the 70s.
Okay.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Okay, go ahead.
At a series of hearings. The food manufacturers there, some scientists that work for the food manufacturers that were defending it, were there as well. And what Dr. Olney showed clearly was that in the concentrations that were being added to food, particularly in small children, this was doing damage that we were being that we were seeing in these animals. Well, the really scary part was that if you look at all animals, they all develop damage from this. Humans are five times more sensitive to this MSG toxicity than is the next most sensitive animal, which is a mouse. So we're five times more sensitive than the mouse. We're 20 times more sensitive than a rhesus monkey. So that puts human beings way at the top of the list of who's sensitive to this foodborne excitotoxin, MSG. And not only do we have higher sensitivity, but it seems to be based on the fact that when humans consume foods or consume MSG, their blood levels go sky high, 20-fold to as high as 50-fold, particularly in children. And it lasts longer, so the blood glutamate levels are elevated longer. Well, one of the defenses that came along early was, well, the brain has a protective system called the blood-brain barrier, and this glutamate cannot pass it from the blood. Well, extensive research since that time has shown that's not true. In fact, if you continuously elevate the blood glutamate, this happens in people that are eating this all day long and snacking on it, it will pass through what we call the CVO system, which is a circumventricular organs, and that's places where there's no barrier. So it's sort of a back door into the brain from the blood. So if you keep your glutamate levels in your blood elevated from eating this type of food, it will increase in the brain, and if the brain is impaired in any way in its protective systems, which is very common, you gradually develop slow damage to your brain. Now, the amount of damage varies considerably. Some people are extremely sensitive, and they develop severe brain disorders. Some people are mildly sensitive, and some people are very resistant to the toxicity. So if you feed the same dose of MSG to 100 people, you're going to see different reactions. Some people develop severe intense headaches, flushing, rapid heartbeat, diarrhea, explosive diarrhea. Some people develop just subtle clouding. It's hard to think. It's hard to talk. Difficulty putting their thoughts together, sort of a fogginess of the mind. And some people just have very few symptoms, if any. Now, that changes. We found out that the most sensitive period is in young babies and children.
And didn't they used to put MSG in baby food?
They did. They put it in baby food and toddler food. And in fact, the toddler food, you can still find it. But what you see is that at that age group, that young age group, they're about four times more sensitive than would be someone in their 20s. That sensitivity begins to subside somewhat as a child reaches their later teenage years, goes into their 20s, up to about 40 years of age. Then sensitivity starts increasing again, so that by the time you're 50, 60, 70, your sensitivity to this brain toxin increases dramatically again. And part of that's because your defense system gets weaker as you get older. The blood-brain barrier begins to break down in a large number of people. When we look at the people who are most at risk from this, it's people with such things as reactive hypoglycemia, that is low blood sugars. That not only makes you sensitive to what you eat as an excitotoxin, but it actually makes the brain start secreting its own glutamate, and so together the two of them maximize the damage to the brain. And this it accounts for a lot of the symptoms of reactive hypoglycemia. For instance, people that have that notice that they get real anxious.
Mm-hmm.
They can have panic attacks, Their temper's very short. They have insomnia. They can't sleep. They suffer from things like forced thinking, where your brain is just like it's on a VCR, just racing at full speed, or a DVD, mm-hmm. just racing at full speed. And that's the glutamate effect. It's because it's overstimulating your brain cells. Well, you keep doing that, eventually you're accumulating damage in critical areas of the brain, particularly memory, learning, control of emotions, behavior. You develop depression. Depression's very closely related to elevated brain glutamate sensitivity. People who have poor diets, they don't have the antioxidants to protect them. Their brain cells are weak based on that, so that they're more sensitive to these excitotoxic effects. Some people are born with a hypersensitivity to these things.
What are some of these excitotoxins? I mean, we know about MSG, although many people feel like they are avoiding MSG, but they're not really, because it's hidden. Isn't that true in many products?
Yeah, what the food manufacturers did, particularly when my book came out, because this was the first major book that really put forth the hard science, the thing that was irrefutable. So what they did, they said, and in fact, one of the manufacturers told me this. He's one of the biggest manufacturers of food additives, and he said, no matter what you say, we're going to figure a way to put it back in the food. We're going to disguise the names.
Wow.
And that's what they do. And what the government legislation says is, if it's less than 98% pure MSG, they can call it anything they want to. So what the manufacturers will do is they'll use things like hydrolyzed protein, isolated protein extract, caseinate's a very common name, natural flavoring, autolyzed yeast enzymes, carrageenan, stock, broth. There's all kinds of disguised names. The list keeps growing. And what this does, it allows them to put not only one, but three or four different forms of high glutamate additives in your food. And I check the stores regularly and look at labels. And what I see happening is there's a lot of processed foods that contain two and three, as much as five different forms of these excitotoxin additives in a single food. And we know that there's a synergistic action of these toxins, so that if you do that, add a little bit of each, you get magnification of the toxicity. So even though it appears to be a low dose, it actually produces full toxicity to these brain cells, and it easily penetrates the brain. And what concerns me is a lot of these foods are being consumed in large amounts by small children. You'll see little 2 and 3 year olds with a bag of Doritos, which has three or four forms of these excitotoxins in it. That's why they taste so good. They're eating them as snacks, and the kids go berserk, and mom can't control them, throwing things and screaming and hollering, and they don't know why. Well, it's the brain's in a state of hyperactivity. You clear this out of their food. Most of the mothers I've worked with say it's almost like I have a new child. They can't believe it. They said he's well-behaved, he's no longer throwing things and having fits. Is well controlled. And so, you know, they're quite satisfied, and they had no idea beforehand that these foods could have such a profound effect. Well, in their older age group, what we see is there's a recent study coming out of Orthodox Medicine that's saying that we're seeing an increased number of adults complaining of clouded thinking, difficulty concentrating. Well, it's the same thing in that age group. It affects mainly the frontal lobes and the temporal lobes, which control your learning, memory, conscious thinking, and it's interfering with that ability. So they have this clouded thinking problem. They get off of it, clear it up, and they get a lot better. So any kind of neurological disease, if you have multiple sclerosis, migraine, headaches, if you have Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, age-related memory problems, a diet high in this glutamate additive is just going to make everything worse and make your disease progress a lot faster. Now, this is all based on really good science. But there's a number of ways also to protect yourself against this excitotoxicity. But before we get into that, it's important to emphasize the importance of this because of its profound effect on brain function, spinal cord function. And people are completely unaware of this. We're seeing a real problem with insomnia. People are complaining they can't sleep and they take sleeping pills. Well, that's a $1 billion business. And they don't realize, well, if they eat a dinner at night that contains high levels of glutamate, it's going to last for hours. And so their minds are going to be racing and they can't sleep. That's a very common complication of this hyperactivity of the brain. People who have problems with major depression, anxiety, we find that glutamate receptors are playing a major role in depression. In fact, one of the glutamate blockers, ketamine, has been shown a single dose can cure some of the most difficult cases of major depression that can last for months.
Well, that's amazing. And you look at the amount of processed food that is sold in our grocery stores, and is it any wonder why much of the population is depressed?
Sure. And it's being totally unrecognized by the orthodox medicine people. I write a number of scientific papers for neurologists, neurosurgeons on this subject. And even at the major medical centers, the feedback I'm getting is that they tell me, I never knew any of this. I never heard of this. So even though the neuroscience, the scientists who work in the laboratories, are writing extensively about it, the practicing physician is not reading this literature, so they're not aware that the new thinking in depression and anxiety and panic attacks is that it's a glutamate excess problem. It's not what we used to think. It's not the serotonin. In fact, the serotonin is interacting with the glutamate, and that's why the serotonin is even related to it at all. I wrote a paper recently on explaining this effect in football players with the chronic traumatic encephalopathy you're hearing a lot about, that they're becoming demented at a young age and having suicidal problems. Well, we know suicide's closely correlated with brain glutamate excess, and it's linked to the depression and suicide risk. And that drugs that and natural foods that block the glutamate excess help treat suicidal tendencies and depression and anxiety. So despite the fact that all of this is really a hot area of research and neuroscience, unfortunately, the practicing physicians never heard of it. So when the patient goes to the doctor and says, you know, I heard that glutamate in the food is playing a big part in depression, he said, well, how could that be? You know, because he doesn't know about glutamate receptors. He doesn't know about the function of glutamate in depression and anxiety, because all this literature is way over his head. I've had a lot of problems explaining this even to physicians because it's all new to them. They're just not familiar with this literature. They're many years behind the times in terms of what we know.
And one of the excitotoxins that you mentioned was carrageenan. And I have seen this ingredient, I know, on some organic products.
Sure.
And yeah. I think that's amazing. Can you explain a little bit? Do you know much about what that does to the brain and to the body?
Yeah, unfortunately, when I go through a lot of health food stores and look at products and things that are supposed to be natural, I see a lot of excitotoxins in some of these things. All the soy products, or the soy concentrates, the whey protein, all of this is high in glutamate. That does not make me popular among the alternative medicine people.
How bad.
But people that are going to these stores for their health should be aware of this. I've seen people that follow the health food diet exactly with severe migraines, and they just can't get well. And I said, well, the natural food you're eating and these supplements are just filled with glutamate, one of the principal causes of migraine. Stop taking it, and it'll go away. And they're amazed. They stop the soy products, and their migraines go away. As far as the carrageenan, what we've always known is that carrageenan, a seaweed extract, is a powerful inducer of inflammation in the body. In fact, it's so powerful, even in very dilute solutions, it can produce such intense inflammation. It's used in all the experiments to test arthritis and other inflammatory diseases. They'll take animals, inject a small amount in their joints or their footpad, and produce inflammation, and so they can test anti-inflammatory drugs. So it's a very powerful inflammatory, and it also, as a breakdown product, releases glutamate and contains higher levels of glutamate. Well, one of the effects of glutamate is not just brain irritation directly by stimulating receptors, but it also makes the brain inflamed. It triggers inflammatory pathways. And I've linked those two together and coined the term immunoexcitotoxicity, which is an inflammation in link with the excitotoxicity. Well, carrageenan is the perfect ingredient to produce immunoexcitotoxicity, because it produces both inflammation and triggers excitotoxicity. Some of the manufacturers, you know, when I first started putting this out, well, they came to the defense, well, ours is not the small molecule carrageenan, which produces all these effects you say. Ours is a large molecule. Well, as it was shown by an expert in GI medicine, he said, well, that's ridiculous, because you take the large molecule, your enzymes and acid in your stomach breaks it down into the small molecule.
Mm.
In fact, it's highly carcinogenic when they do experiments on colon cancer. To get the animals to develop the tumors, they feed them very small dilute amounts of carrageenan to cause the bowel to become inflamed, so they'll become cancerous. Well, people who have Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, irritable bowel syndrome, these disorders, you certainly don't want to inflame your bowel, but that's what carrageenan does. Now, one of the big shocks of this whole glutamate field was that glutamate receptors have now been found everywhere. They're in every organ, every cell in the body, pancreas, heart, lungs, GI tract, everywhere, blood vessels. And they're even found in plants throughout the plant kingdom. They use glutamate as a transmitter. So it's a ubiquitous transmitter in everything. Now, because it's found, we find these glutamate transmitters in every organ and tissue, they begin to look at and see, well, what kind of pathological effect of overstimulation occurs? Well, they're finding that, in fact, if you feed animals glutamate early in life, they become morbidly obese later in life, and they develop insulin resistance. They develop the metabolic syndrome. And it's repeatable. Every animal species you do that to, they develop metabolic syndrome and obesity. Well, what's the big problem in America today?
Obesity.
Obesity and metabolic syndrome. Some 48 million Americans have full-blown metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. When we look at countries that eat very little of this, the incidence of these two disorders is very low. Now, the German scientists are really on top of this. They're looking at large populations and doing experimental studies showing, yes, indeed, the amount of glutamates in food is so high now. Probably we're producing in countries like the United States gross obesity and metabolic syndrome and all the diseases associated with that, based on the fact that consuming so much of this stuff in processed foods. When you look at what people eat, and I like to watch people put stuff in their shopping carts.
I do the same thing. I'm amazed.
And I'm just amazed at the amount of glutamate-containing foods they're buying and feeding the small children. In fact, I was in line. I saw a woman take a Diet Cola, put it in a baby bottle, and give it to her baby. And I was just astounded.
That must have been hard, to not say anything.
I know, but I've learned not to, because you'll get some bad reactions sometimes. Tell you, mind your own business. But it's such a powerful brain toxin in small children.
Yeah.
And it's so powerfully carcinogenic.
And in pregnant mothers also, too. Isn't that true? In pregnant women?
Oh, yeah, because the placenta concentrates it on the baby's side. So the baby is getting a higher dose than the mother. And, of course, the baby's small size and immature brain is infinitely more sensitive to this toxicity. So the poor baby is getting a large dose. And the brain is undergoing its most rapid and complex formation during the last trimester of pregnancy and the first 2 years of life. So when the mother's consuming this stuff, it's affecting the baby's brain formation. And I've done some extensive studies on glutamate and brain formation. And what we know is that glutamate plays a major role in how the brain forms all these complex pathways. And if there's too much glutamate, it severely interferes with the formation of the brain. Any time during that period, that last trimester of pregnancy and the first 2 years of life being most sensitive. And that can affect the child's behavior and ability to learn and IQ and all of these things for a lifetime because the brain connections are just abnormal. The brain is abnormally wired because this concentration of glutamate is so critical. And there's a timed rise and fall in glutamate in a developing brain. It has to be exact. So if you're consuming a lot of this stuff, you're just really messing up that time cyclic change in brain glutamate.
What about obstetricians? Are they any more aware?
They've never heard of it.
Oh, it's amazing because they could, you know, they could use that in their practice. And
well, they should. All of this should be applied, and people should be warned. Mothers should be told. But unfortunately, even in speaking with neurosurgeons and neurologists about these things, I'm telling you, they don't know about these things. Well, the obstetrician sure has never heard of it. So anybody I've spoke with in obstetrics, they have no clue what I'm talking about, and they assume that it's no importance. Because, you know, in medicine, what you tend to do is you wait for your specialty society to tell you something's important. So if your society, the American Society of Obstetrics and Gynecology, doesn't inform you that you should start telling women and counseling them to avoid glutamate additives, then they'll do it. But if they don't, they ignore it. It must not be important. Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of reasons that these leaders in these different specialties don't speak about it. One is some of them are on the payroll, some are getting money, but a lot is just ignorance. They don't know about this.
Mm-hmm.
They're unaware of it.
Right. What about glutamate and cancer? Have you done any research around this?
Well, I've done a lot, and that's an area that's really captured my attention in all of this fact that every organ has glutamate receptors. And what was discovered first with brain tumors, we dealt, as a neurosurgeon, dealt a lot with the very malignant glioblastoma-type brain tumors, a very deadly tumor. And we haven't had any improvement in treatment and survival over the last 30 years. But what we found out was that the tumors that have high glutamate levels are the worst prognosis. They grow the fastest, and they're more invasive into the brain, surrounding brain, than the ones with low glutamate. So glutamate is a powerful stimulant for the growth of these brain tumors, and particularly their invasion. Now, then they started looking at other tumors. Said, what about melanomas? What about the lung tumors, breast cancers, prostate cancer? They found the same thing. The tumors that had the greatest amount of glutamate and glutamate receptors had the worst prognosis. They were the most aggressive, they invaded the most, and most likely to kill in a short period of time. Tumors with very little glutamate receptors did fairly well. They acted rather benign. When they looked at all these tumors and found the same thing, they said, well, what if we block the glutamate receptors? So they took some cancers, they blocked glutamate receptors, and lo and behold, that's exactly what they saw, was that the cancer started slowing down its growth considerably, became considerably less invasive. And so when they combined chemotherapy with the glutamate blocking, they found that the chemotherapy worked infinitely better. So the glutamate and the receptors on these cancer cells is playing a major role in how aggressive and deadly these cancers are. Well, I did a little studying, and I started getting the dietary recommendations of the cancer dietitians from all the major oncology centers around the United States. What I found was shocking on many levels. They were telling their cancer patients, the most important thing to do is eat. It doesn't matter what you eat, just eat.
Oh, no.
They were telling them to eat cakes and pies and pizza. All these kind of things. And then I started looking through the list of food. I said, well, number one, the sugar is a major cancer stimulant. And they're telling them to eat a lot of sugar. The other thing was a lot of these foods were very high in glutamate. Even naturally, some of them were naturally high in glutamate. And that was feeding their tumors. No one was telling the cancer patient, you should avoid these foods and these additives. And they still don't. In fact, I gave a lecture before an audience, and I mentioned that the oncologists don't tell their patients, and the oncologist from the audience came up to me and said, was insulted that I said such a thing, that they don't inform their patients. So I said, well, do you inform your patients about the danger of glutamate? He said, well, no. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, our society didn't tell us to.
Hmm.
And I was astounded. I said, well, you know, are you a child in kindergarten that you have to have your teacher tell you to do things? I said, I get this material out of your journals. This is in all the cancer journals, the cancer research journals. This is a big area of research, glutamate and cancer growth. Yet because they had not been informed by their society to tell their patients, they just ignored it. And
well, that's interesting. It's kind of like the man in the white coat looking for the man in the white coat.
That's right.
Permission.
The elitist in the white
coat. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, to tell me what I do, what I say.
Well,
you know, you're supposed to be a physician. You're not a government worker, a bureaucrat who has to wait for the supervisor to tell them what to do.
Yeah, and we're dealing with people's lives. You know?
Sure, and this is making a big difference in whether you survive. For instance, breast cancer. We know that glutamate receptors in breast cancer cells play a major role in whether or not that cancer is going to kill the woman and whether it's going to be a rapid-growing, highly invasive and metastatic cancer. And that if you use glutamate blockers and some other things that reduce inflammation, you can change a stage 4 cancer into a cancer you can live with, a normal lifespan. And unfortunately, patients are not being told this. The weapons we have against cancer are enormous if you look outside of the drugs. The drugs have been uniformly unsuccessful for metastatic and invasive cancers. You know, if you look at the literature, it says that chemotherapy works in only about 5 to 10% of patients who have invasive metastatic cancers.
Yeah, and I thought that number was lower. I've interviewed Charlotte Gerson on my show, and she said that was like 2 to 5%. So,
well, they probably use an inflated figure,
right,
to not look so bad. But you know, most patients who are found to have a tumor that's already metastasized will die within months to a year.
Yeah.
But what I'm looking at in seeing alternative medicine is a lot of patients with extensive metastasis are living decades in good health, and their cancer's not growing. Most of their tumors disappear. So when we look at the cancer literature closely, which is looking at a lot of these compounds, like curcumin and quercetin, we're finding out that there's good, hard science as to why it works and why it is so much better than chemotherapy. And in fact, it makes chemotherapy safer and more effective.
Well, you know, as you and I know, it's a billion-dollar business, and cancer's big business, so I
sure,
think there's you know, we all know it's about the money, unfortunately.
If you take, for instance, let's just use a case. If you have a woman who's has a strong family history of breast cancer, she's 25 years old, and she continues to eat a diet that's high in sugar, high in omega-6 fatty acids, which are pro-inflammatory, and a lot of glutamate. She is increasing her risk of developing that highly invasive cancer far greater, many-fold, over 10, 15-fold higher than a woman who carefully watches her diet avoids the high sugar, avoids the omega-6 fats and the glutamate additives in her food, and pays attention to her inflammatory level. Now, the worst thing she can do is get mammograms every year, because now she has a defect in this BRCA1, BRCA2, which is a DNA repair enzyme. So if it's impaired, that means the radiation damage done by the mammogram cannot be fixed.
Mm.
So every time she gets a mammogram, she's dramatically increasing her risk of developing a highly invasive cancer. And if she continues to eat the glutamate and the other things, when it does develop, it's going to be very, very aggressive. No one's telling these patients that. They're not being told. So, you know, for the normal woman who is at some risk for breast cancer, she can dramatically reduce her risk by her diet and avoiding these excitotoxins. But this is also true for things, let's say, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome. The gut is just filled with glutamate receptors.
Mm-hmm.
It's now being shown that these receptors are playing a big role in these diseases, and that if you reduce the glutamate stimulation, these people get a lot better. Chronic fatigue syndrome, we're finding that the glutamate receptors in the muscle are playing a big role. Pulmonary disease, asthma, pancreatitis, pancreatic disorders, ovarian cystic disease. All of these diseases are being found related to these peripheral glutamate receptors. Now, when you eat a diet high in glutamate, the rest of the body, there's no barrier. Whatever you eat goes directly to that tissue or that organ. Heart disease, arrhythmias, the entire electrical system of the heart is controlled by glutamate. So if you're a heart patient and you have very labile arrhythmias that's not responding to medications very well, and you're eating a diet high in glutamate, you're at very high risk of having a fatal arrhythmia. If your magnesium level is low, which increases the sensitivity of these glutamate receptors, then you're really at a high risk of dying suddenly. So sudden cardiac death is strongly correlated with that combination of low magnesium and high intake of glutamate.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And I see this in a lot of heart patients. Nobody's telling them that the glutamate makes the heart hypersensitive and very irritable. The low magnesium makes it so irritable, because magnesium controls one of the glutamate receptors, that they'll die suddenly. They'll eat a meal. I've witnessed a young man in a restaurant who ate some soup, and he died. No matter what they did in terms of resuscitation, he couldn't be resuscitated, and died of an arrhythmia, which I was convinced was probably high glutamate in the soup he was consuming. So there's no telling how many thousands of people are dying of these things, and it's being passed off in the emergency room as just a sudden fatal arrhythmia. We don't know why, but we do know why.
Yeah. Well, we certainly could talk for hours on excitotoxins and what they do, but your book has a lot of this information in it.
Yeah, Excitotoxins, the Taste That Kills.
Okay.
It was published in last 1997. I need to update it because a good deal of the physiology is gone far beyond what's in the book, but most of the things that would apply clinically in the book are still true.
Okay, and your website, for people who want to go and see more of your research, what is your website?
Well, my website is RussellBlaylockMD.com. My son has a website in which he puts a lot of information as well, and links to books and DVDs and things I've done on these subjects, which is BlaylockWellnessCenter.com. That's BlaylockCenter.com center.com.
And you can sign up for a newsletter on that page.
The Blaylock Wellness Report, which I update a lot of these things about glutamate and heart sensitivity and sudden cardiac death. I talk about a lot of different things and links, for instance, to diabetes. Because exposure to glutamate, particularly early in life, makes you insulin resistant, so people develop type 2 diabetes as part of the metabolic syndrome. But it just explains a lot of this in detail and what you can do about it.
Right. You know. Well, let's shift gears here, and there's something I wanted to talk about, and that is about chemtrails or geoengineering. And I know that they are spraying aluminum in the atmosphere to what they say is to combat global warming. Can you talk a little bit about this aluminum that is being sprayed and what that is doing to our brains?
Well, my interest in aluminum was the connection to neurological diseases, particularly Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and there's considerable literature showing that accumulation of aluminum in the brain is related to all three of these disorders, and that aluminum activates chronic inflammation in the brain and immunoexcitotoxicity. So that was my interest in aluminum. I'm a friend of a major aluminum researcher, Chris Exley, in England, and he does a lot of research along those lines, and we communicate about it. And what we were concerned about was the nano-aluminum, that is making the particles so small that it's rapidly absorbed through the skin, through the mucous membranes and lungs, but also a particular thing of interest to mine was the fact that when you breathe air that contains nano-aluminum, it's rapidly absorbed through the mucosa, the lining of the nose, and enters the olfactory nerves, which are the smell nerves. And these olfactory nerves carry this nano-aluminum directly to the part of the brain that's first affected in Alzheimer's disease and most severely affected in Alzheimer's disease, and that's the entorhinal cortex and the hippocampus. When you look at Alzheimer's patients and measure aluminum levels, you see the highest level at that entry point from the olfactory nerve into the entorhinal cortex. So we have good evidence that aluminum is entering the nose and entering the part of the brain that's affected in Alzheimer's, causing abnormalities in memory and learning and attention and concentration. When you do this experimentally, you can trace this with a radioactive tracer and watch the nano-aluminum pass along that nerve into the brain, and then it's distributed throughout the brain. You keep doing that day after day, the levels get pretty high. Now, my concern with the geoengineering was the word I got, and when I started looking it up, and one of the conferences in which their speaker was talking about it, they talked about using nano-aluminum, and the reason they were using it, they say, well, it stays suspended in the atmosphere longer because the particle's so small and it acts like a cloud to reflect the heat supposedly back out into outer space. Well, the problem is it slowly descends down to the earth, enters the lakes and streams, plants take it up. So then the aluminum content of the plants we eat is much higher, the water we drink is much higher, and we breathe it. The filters in house filtering systems not small enough to filter it out, so gradually nano-aluminum content inside your house elevates. And what we know is that nano-aluminum is infinitely more inflammatory than normal-sized aluminum, so it's more toxic to the brain. Once it gets in, and it can penetrate all parts of the cell. It easily passes through the membranes and blood-brain barrier, etc. So knowing all of this, I was just astounded that they were spraying hundreds and thousands of tons of nano-aluminum all over the world, particularly the United States. And I, you know, did a little research and looked in my own case in my skies, and I see these tight patterns, and it's obvious a pattern. It's not contrails. The whole thing of contrails is nonsense. You'd watch a plane fly, and it turns on this cloud and of material coming out of the back of it, and it stops, and there's a break, and then it starts back up. Well, I knew the jet's not cutting his engine off.
Right.
So, you know, you have a 747 or a 767 or something, we know it's not turning its engine on and off, and we know that it's not flying in a checkered pattern. And then pretty soon, for instance, we've noticed lately There's been none of the chemtrails, or very few of them. Well, did the flight stop over the United States for the last month? Well, no.
Yeah.
We usually have about the same number of flights every day, every week, every month. So those chemtrails should be the same, but they don't. They vary considerably. You'll see periods in which there's very dense trails, chemtrails in the sky, and periods where there's hardly any, but there's just as many flights.
But there's many skeptics out there that will say, you know, I mean, for me, when I start talking about geoengineering, I just kind of watch people's eyes glaze over and they're going, right. And, you know, I think that's very much by design. There's a lot of people out there that it's their job to debunk this information.
Well, one of the greatest successes they had is to create the idea that anything that smacks of a conspiracy theory is loony.
Right.
Which gives great cover for people who are conspiring things. Now, if you look on a local level, you say, oh, well, yeah, I know conspiracy. There's a politician here who worked his way onto the city council, and he has a landscaping business, and he got laws passed, so you have to meet these landscaping recommendations or you get fined, and he's making a lot of money out of it. Well, that's a local conspiracy. Well, I know this other guy owns a big company, and he's pushed in Washington to get a law passed that'll benefit his company. Well, that's a conspiracy on a larger level, a higher level. And you say, well, do you think that people that have amounts of money into trillions of dollars, we're talking about huge amounts of money, who write extensively about theories about how they think the world should be designed, do you think they just do nothing? That you can see it on a local level, you can see it on a state level, a county level, but for somehow when we get higher up to the really big money, no conspiracies occur.
Right.
Everything is just the way you think it should be. Well, that's nonsense. You know, no rational mind would say that. Now, there are crazy conspiracies, and there's conspiracies that are well thought out. The geoengineering, and I've watched, you know, conferences by the people doing geoengineering, and one in which he says, well, we're, you know, considering using nano-aluminum. And so someone asked, what about the toxicity of aluminum? And his response was, well, we'll do some studies on it to see. Well, I'm thinking at the whole time, well, gee, you know, there's compelling evidence. There's thousands of studies on the toxicity of aluminum. You don't need to do studies. So this is from people who are actually in governmental conferences on geoengineering. That takes it out of the conspiracy realm. This is out of the horse's mouth. We know that the conferences on global warming all include talks and discussions of geoengineering. So, you know, it's like a detective story. You put all the data together that's hard facts and their own facts. It pretty soon it becomes undeniable, and you ask the people who refute you and roll their eyes, well, how do you explain it?
Right.
Well, I don't know. You know, well, don't you think it behooves you to find out?
Yeah. Well, I've had people, you know, on the show like Rosalind Peterson and Dane Wigington, and their evidence is indisputable. And Dane Wigington challenges anyone. Actually, he wanted me to do a show if I could find someone that would challenge him. And I haven't been able to find anybody.
Well, they can't, because if you look at some of the things that's been done, for instance, biologists have gone into some of these areas where there's extensive spraying, and they measured the aluminum level before the spraying started in the local lakes and streams and snow, and found out that after the spraying, the levels of aluminum went up astronomically, thousand-fold increases. When they measured in the plants and trees, massive increases in the aluminum. So your question to the eye roller is, well, where do you think this aluminum came from? I don't know. Well, it's time to find out.
Yes.
You can't just roll your eyes and scoff. If you can't explain how a lake within a year or months can increase its aluminum level to that degree, then I think somebody needs to start paying attention. It's not something that naturally occurs. There hasn't been a volcano close by that's spewing aluminum in it. So, you know, to the skeptic that rolls their eyes, you tend to question them closely. Well, what is your explanation? You know, how could you explain this outside of this? And most of the time, well, I don't know. I have no idea. And well, you're the type of person who just buries their head in the sand and could care less. We want to know. We think this is important enough. We need to find out why. Who's behind it? What's going on? What are the motives? What's the plan here?
Right.
You know, and one of the things I saw was that with this global warming is when you put a nano aluminum in the atmosphere and you combine it with HARP, which, you know, we know increases the certain wavelengths of electromagnetic energy in the ionosphere and these upper atmospheric labor. Well, it's certainly going to affect aluminum,
right.
Nano-sized aluminum, which is highly conductive.
And for our listeners that don't know what HAARP is, it's H-A-A-R-P. Just Google it and look it up. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a system to supposedly experiments on changing the ionosphere through high-intensity electromagnetic waves. It's been designed up in Alaska, and Russia has one of their own. And you can get on the site of HAARP itself, and it'll tell you about it. They interview their own scientists and tell you what they're doing. So my fear is you can severely affect weather by activating this nanoalum in the ionosphere, and that's going to produce tremendous changes in these layers of heat and cold interacting into storms, et cetera. So it goes extensively beyond just the direct health effect. There's all kinds of effects. And nobody wants to answer questions. People have gone to Congress. They've asked their congressmen. The congressmen know nothing about it and don't show any interest in it. There's no investigating committees. There's no oversight. So, you know, if you want to quell a conspiracy, then use transparency. If we're wrong and we're on the wrong step, then open up your files. Let's see what's going on in these closed-door meetings. But they don't. They keep them closed. They keep them top secret. They refuse to release their information.
Right. Well, what about the barium and strontium? Do you have any comments about the health effects that the combination with the aluminum could cause?
Well, most of these things that have some neurological effect, if you combine it with something that's a more powerful neural toxin or toxic substance such as aluminum, it magnifies it either additively or synergistically. For instance, if you take a very weak toxin that if you give it to an animal, it doesn't really cause any problem. And then you test the animal with another weak toxin that's such a low level, it causes no problem. And then if you mix the two together and give it to the animal, then they develop severe toxicity. That's what synergism is. So we know that happens a lot in nature, that you take weak toxins, you mix them together, you produce a full-blown, very powerful toxin. Most things that are tested by the government are never tested for synergistic or additive toxicity. And so when you take something like the chemtrail, where you're mixing barium and strontium and nanoaluminum, you can produce a very strong, powerful neurotoxin and a toxin to the lung and other organs as well. It's not a benign thing, and I can't imagine how anyone could stand up there and say, well, this is perfectly safe to fill the atmosphere with these chemicals and fill the plants and the streams and lakes and drinking water with this. You know, that's just insane. No one could stand up and defend that.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've heard of is that there's a link between autism and aluminum, and not only through vaccines, but I was thinking about the aluminum in the nanoparticles in our atmosphere and how that may be affecting even pregnant women.
Well, it certainly can. you know, if you would ask a neurotoxicologist, is it a safe thing to inject a woman with aluminum during pregnancy? He said, of course not. Aluminum's a neurotoxic substance. But that's exactly what you would be doing with nano aluminum. If she's breathing it during her pregnancy, particularly that last trimester, that third of her pregnancy, it's passed through the placenta very easily into the baby's brain and tissues, and it's going to have a profound effect. And if that baby is being exposed during development to this nano-aluminum and then the rest of its life, can you imagine what's going to happen when it's a teenager? We're already seeing a dramatic increase in degenerative brain disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. I predict if they're really doing this, if they're spraying the atmosphere with nano-aluminum all the time, there's going to be a dramatic increase in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, as well as a number of neurologic disorders.
Well, what is there anything we can do to counter the effects of all this aluminum?
Yeah, a number of supplements have been shown to bind and neutralize aluminum toxicity. For instance, curcumin, which is a flavonoid extract of the spice turmeric. Quercetin helps neutralize it.
Quercetin? Saffron. I have taken quercetin for allergies. Is it the same thing?
Sure,
that's interesting.
It's an anti-inflammatory.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. What else?
The problem with quercetin is absorption. It's poorly absorbed. When you mix it with extra virgin olive oil, you increase absorption 12-fold.
Oh, wow.
So you can dramatically increase your absorption by mixing with extra virgin olive oil. But mixing curcumin and quercetin together is really good for allergies. And you can neutralize a lot of aluminum toxicity with curcumin in the brain and any tissue. Saffron has been shown to reduce brain aluminum levels.
Really?
Any anti-inflammatory flavonoid in the brain like lutein, apigenin, these things neutralize a lot of these toxic effects and reduce immunoexcitotoxicity. Skullcap extract, which contains bicalium, it neutralizes it. So there's just a whole host of plant extracts that help neutralize aluminum toxicity.
And what about just foods in general? Are there any foods that will assist, you know, besides, you know, some of the things that you mentioned, like just vegetables or?
Well, the vegetables contain these flavonoids. You know,
okay.
Quercetin is the most common flavonoid in vegetables, onions particularly, and tea and shallots and things like that. But most of your leafy green vegetables, your cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, kale, spinach, all of these things contain powerful flavonoids that help neutralize this toxicity. Now, certain teas like black tea, which is what most people drink, contains high level of fluoride. And fluoride binds with aluminum very avidly, forms a fluoraluminum compound, which is infinitely more toxic than either fluoride or aluminum alone.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another danger, is that you're fluoridating the drinking water, plus you're adding aluminum to it, plus you're putting a chemtrail nano-aluminum in it. So you're producing some very, very highly toxic fluoraluminum compounds, which is even in half the concentration they use to fluoridate water, is brain toxic.
Right.
And
it happens in so many different cities, and it's just amazing. I know that Portland just passed an ordinance to remove the fluoride from their drinking water, but
right.
I think if enough people, you know, can really find out about fluoride, then we can start affecting change in cities to create what Portland has created.
Yeah, I wrote a chapter in my book, Health and Nutrition Secrets, on fluoride, which is probably one of the longer chapters. But it goes into a lot of detail of the whole fluoride fight and how it was covered up and what it does to the brain and other tissues and floor aluminum things. But you need to get things like that chapter and read it to educate yourself, because the fluoride is so enormously toxic to numerous organ systems. The whole story of it preventing cavities is an absolute lie.
Right.
But the public is fooled by it, and unfortunately most dentists aren't aware, and physicians know absolutely nothing about it. I used to argue with my physician friends inside and out, and they're clueless. They don't have a clue.
Well, you know, it seems, given all this information, you just really need to be your own health advocate these days. And
well, you do. You can't just assume that the government's protecting you. You can't assume your physician knows these things or your dentist, because they don't. You know, this stuff is buried in thousands of research articles. Major laboratories are uncovering these things. Physicians don't read that. They read clinical articles. It takes decades before things leave the research lab and end up in clinical medicine. So most practicing medicine is about 20 years, 30 years behind what we actually know.
Wow. Now that's amazing.
Oh, it's well known. I mean, it's just, clinical medicine is so far behind. And, of course, it's captivated by the pharmaceutical industry. You know, the doctor thinks the answer to everything is a drug,
right,
a prescription, because it's what you're taught.
Right.
You know, when I was in med school, that's what they taught us. When I was a resident, that's what they taught us. If a drug couldn't cure it, it was labeled an incurable disease, which is nonsense, because you do other things. And what I've seen and shocked me was so many so-called incurable diseases cured. So I tell patients, well, if your doctor says it's incurable and there's nothing to do, well, he's right, according to his plan. But that doesn't mean your disease can't be cured or made better.
You know, I wanted to talk just briefly, and I know this is a broad subject, but just wanted to touch on this subject about vaccines and autism. We still have so many people resisting the evidence of this connection. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's two categories. One are the people who are making massive profits off of it. For instance, Offit, who is the dancing fool of vaccines, he's made millions off vaccines he's developed. So he has a vested interest in promoting the safety of vaccines, and he makes some absolutely illogical, idiotic statements like, oh, a person could take 10,000 vaccines and be perfectly safe. Well, I've challenged him over the radio, take 100. I'll pick 100 vaccines. You take them in one day, and let's see how you do. Well, he won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the man's not honest. He's intellectually dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
The one group is these people. The other group is the mass of the medical profession who knows almost nothing about immunology. They know very little about pathological disease, infectious disease. They're just being told things. My friends talk about vaccines and stuff. I said, where'd you get that? Well, they hand me a pamphlet that's sent to from their specialty society. And I look on it, it's printed by the pharmaceutical company that makes the vaccine. I look at the posters on their wall. I said, that's a nice poster you have about pneumococcal vaccine. You notice in the corner it comes from the company that makes the vaccine? So the physician's getting his information from the people who are making billions, hundreds of billions of dollars off these vaccines. For instance, pneumococcal vaccine sold to elderly people. Let's say you're 65. Go to your doctor. He tells you, have you had your pneumococcal vaccine yet? Well, no. Well, you need to get it. You know, it's a major killer of people your age. Over 100,000 people, et cetera, die from pneumonia. The doctor didn't bother to go look into the literature, the clinical literature, in which they did several very large studies and found out it had no benefit whatsoever. Did not reduce hospitalizations, did not reduce deaths from pneumococcal pneumonia. He just took the word of the vaccine company that they had to get it to protect themselves. Same thing with flu vaccines. They did a huge study on a 30-year study following people, thousands, tens of thousands of people to see, did it actually stop hospitalizations, pneumonia, and death from flu? You know what they found out? It had no effect. Zero effect. Yet every doctor you walk around, you got to get your flu shot. You're 60 years old. You're at high risk of dying. 18,000 people die every year from flu, you know. And he never goes or looks at the literature that did a very careful study to see if there's any benefit. In fact, it's no benefit. Even when you look on their own site, you know, like CDC, the Center for Disease Control, look on their site and it says, well, the flu vaccine may have a 30% beneficial effect, as low as 20%. Well, if an elderly person walked in your office and said, well, you got an 80% chance to a 9% chance this vaccine is not going to do you any good at all, but you could end up paralyzed for life. You could end up demented. You could end up having seizures the rest of your life. Now, how many people would take the flu shot if you just gave the truth that's in the literature? Well, most wouldn't. They say, I'm not going to risk being paralyzed mm-hmm. for the rest of my life or having seizures or being demented on the off chance that I might fall in that 20 or 30% that possibly could benefit. Well, when they looked at different categories, for instance, they look at small children under age 4, which the CDC every year tells, we got to vaccinate those little kids down to 6 months of age because they're at the highest risk. Well, two things. Now, when you look at their data, it says, no, they're not at the highest risk. And number two, the vaccine has zero effectiveness. None. Yet they're vaccinating these kids just regularly, vaccinating pregnant women, and the studies say it has no benefit.
And are they using nanoaluminum in these vaccines?
Sure. They use the aluminum and a great number of the vaccines. And some of them are very high levels, like Gardasil, tetanus shot, hepatitis B has very high levels of aluminum. And these are your most toxic vaccines. 100 girls have died from the Gardasil shot. Probably hundreds more, if not thousands, have had seizures, neurological problems. Severe weakness, all for a vaccine that's never been shown to prevent one cancer. There's so many lies going on. If we did that, if you did that, mm-hmm. they'd slap you in jail in a minute. For instance, you walk into a doctor's office with your 14-year-old daughter, and the doctor says, she had her Gardasil yet? You say, well, no, I didn't want to get her a Gardasil. Well, she's going to die of cervical cancer if she doesn't get it. And said, you know, almost she'll get it before she gets the car in the parking lot. They're lying. The doctor's not lying purposely, but he's been given this pamphlet full of this propaganda, not based on scientific studies, because the studies say that the incidence of cervical cancer in a woman under 30 is far less than 1%. So you're looking at a 14-year-old girl whose risk is zero, even up to age 25, and you're scaring the daylights of her mother that she's going to die of cervical cancer if she doesn't get this vaccine. Now, that's fraud. That's deception.
I agree.
You see, and normally in any other situation, the person that perpetrated that would go to prison. Well, the vaccine companies went to various state legislatures and secretly got them to pass mandatory vaccination for Gardasil. For all girls 12 or 14 years of age and above. Well, you know, here's all this deception about the vaccine, the dangers of the vaccine. Now they've made it mandatory that if the parent won't vaccinate the girl, they'll take the girl away and forcibly vaccinate her.
That's criminal.
Sure, it's criminal. And even the CDC, when it was exposed that they were secretly doing this in state legislatures, they reluctantly had to condemn it and say, well, you know, that's not right. Well, they knew that was happening because mm-hmm. they go to the CDC and do the same thing. These same vaccine companies go to CDC and say, well, you know, we really need you to tell the nation everyone, age 14, all the girls need to get it. Now all the boys need to get it. That it's going to prevent cancer. And then you look at the study and say, well, you know, there's not a single study that says it prevents cancer. And so, in fact, the women who already are infected with the virus, if you give them the vaccine, it increases their risk of getting cervical cancer. Now, that's from their own study. That's from the pharmaceutical studies. So you say, well, are you testing women to see if they're infected before you give them the shot? Well, no. It's too expensive. So how many women are you inducing cervical cancer in because you're vaccinating them? Well, we don't know. We don't care. We're just making lots of money. You see, so the level of lies, deceptions, hypocrisy, and just intellectual dishonesty is so enormous. And it's all backed up by the government. So if the government backs it up, who's going to prosecute them? Nobody.
Right.
These people can lie on a grand scale, commit fraud, and medical malpractice, and because they're protected by the government, nothing's going to happen.
So what's the answer?
Well, people have to educate themselves. Quit believing everything your doctor says. You know, the doctor needs to be forced. You say, doctor, what are the complications of Gardasil vaccine? I want to know the facts. Don't just tell me it's safe. What is the risk of my daughter getting cervical cancer before age 30? And what you'll find is a lot of stammering. Well, I don't know. I'll have to look it up. Well, why didn't you look it up before you recommended it? You know, if my daughter has 20 years before she's even at any significant risk, even a small risk of cervical cancer, even if she's infected, don't you think cervical cancer by then will be cured anyway? And how many women who get HPV infection ever develop cervical cancer? Do you know that number, doctor? Well, I want to know. Well, actually, over 90% of girls who get HPV infection, they clear it themselves without any treatment. They never told that, just like hepatitis B. Over 90% of people who are infected with hepatitis B cure themselves automatically. Their immune system clears it. They're not told that. They're told scare stories. Oh, you know, I could develop into liver cancer. What percentage of people who are infected with hepatitis B develop liver cancer? Well, actually, it's far less than 0.01%.
Well, fear.
Well, so you're
like
telling me I don't have a risk. My risk is far less than 100%. I'm 99.99% chance I'm not going to get it. I'm not taking that dangerous vaccine.
Right. And again, you know, they use fear. I think that's...
Well, they use fear, but patients need to start quizzing their physician.
Yeah.
And what that'll do, it'll show them and the physician that the physician doesn't know what he's talking about. Asking him critical questions that he or she cannot answer.
Right. And we
and
always...
that's what you need to do.
We always talk about this on Food Integrity Now about, you know, being an advocate for yourself and realizing how much personal power you have, and just don't be afraid to ask questions. Question everything. Right. We live in a time where we really need to do this.
Well, one thing, the internet is a source of so much information, good information. I mean, you can look up cervical cancer from pathology sites. Not anybody on either side of the debate. And look up these things yourself. Well, what is the incidence of cervical cancer at HPV? Look up articles about HPV and cervical cancer. And you'll find, if you carefully analyze it, that your daughter's at a very, very, very low risk of developing cervical cancer. And there's not even clear evidence that HPV by itself can cause cervical cancer. Most of these women that develop cervical cancer have multiple infections. And they're not told that. You know, there's so many things that patients aren't told. It's just it's fear factor.
Mm-hmm.
Come in, let me scare the daylights out of you. That you're going to die if you don't take this, if you don't do this. Well, you know, that's criminal. That's criminal behavior. You're certainly intellectually dishonest. Same thing with chemotherapy. I tell people are going to get chemotherapy. I say, well, ask the doctor a simple question. Ask him, is this going to cure me? What are the chances of a cure? I said, they use very clever language. Oh, these tumors respond very well to this new drug. Define that. Well, what it means is it shrinks for a little while, and then it comes back and kills you. It grows even faster once it comes back. Well, I don't want to know that it responds. I want to know, what are my chances of cure? Well, actually, cure maybe 5%, maybe 10%.
Right. Well, those are certainly great questions to ask your doctor, especially if you're in that situation.
Sure. They did a poll of physicians, asked them, how many of your chemotherapy patients complain of weakness and complications? Oh, very few was the most common answer. They asked the nurse who actually takes care of the patient, how many of these patients complain of severe fatigue and other problems? Almost all of them.
Wow.
See, because the doctor's in, he's out. And your natural response, anybody's been to a doctor knows the same thing, even myself. The doctor walks in, well, how are you doing? We're doing pretty good. And then that's it. But wait a minute, I'm getting ready to tell you, actually, I'm not doing pretty good. It's just a natural response. Well, I'm okay, you know. And then as you get to probing, if you spend time with the patient, well, actually, I have a lot of nausea. I'm very weak. I can't get out of bed. My muscles ache. You see, but I had a partner of mine, and one of his patients told me, he says, that doctor flew in here, and his coattail hadn't touched his rear end before he flew back out. And a lot of doctors are like that. They got a lot of patients to see, so boom, how you doing? Fine, gone. You don't let the nurse take it.
Right, here's a prescription.
Yeah, well, they don't even do that. The nurse gives you a prescription.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Blaylock, for being a guest on our program. This has been just such great information. And if you haven't already done so, I highly recommend you sign up for the Blaylock Wellness Report. And Dr. Blaylock's website is blaylockwellnesscenter.com. And what's your other website?
RussellBlaylockMD.com, RussellBlaylockMD.com.
Okay, great. And I highly recommend our listeners to go to those websites and do some research on your own. And thank you to all our listeners. If you like what you hear, please join us on our website, which is foodintegritynow.org, and stay informed, stay active, and be well. Thank you.